Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. I'd say that the scariest stories in true crime are the ones where an intruder storms a home with rape and murder on his mind. The victims are usually women, sometimes children, rarely, if ever, men. Can you imagine, say, someone like me being raped and murdered in the dead of night by a slobbering maniac? I bet some of you can. It's almost laughable. Men don't really have to worry about that. And I'm pretty sure that I don't either. My point is, the scariest stories to me aren't about me. They're about my kids, my girl, my mother, any woman or child in my life, even outside of it. They're about mentally unstable men becoming unhinged, along with any door they choose to burst in through. There are a lot of men out there susceptible to intrusive thoughts about devolving into an unstoppable intruder. Most just aren't physically capable enough, mentally disturbed enough, neurotic enough to become a Russell Maurice Johnson type. Thank goodness I'm only one for three. And if I manage to get you feeling funny about me here, just do the math. I ain't half bad. It's scary, the mentally ill man. Some are just driving around, being driven nuts by the drive to harm others. I think about those men. I look out for them. But the scariest thing is that in the end, what the fuck am I or are you really going to do about it? Should their demons decide to drive them up the wall or through one to clean house? Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The Clean Freak. Baby, you can cry all night, but that'll never change the way I feel. The snow was really piling up outside. I wish you wouldn't make me leave here. Meatloaf. 2 out of 3 ain't bad. I used to hate Meatloaf. I watched the Rocky Horror Picture Show too early. He was involved in it, and I couldn't stand anything to do with them. It just was a too early of an indoctrination into that world of weird and sexual shit. And these days, I've changed my mind on it. I listen to Meatloaf a lot when I'm cleaning. I mean, I don't consider myself a clean freak, but I am a compulsive tidier. So when the subject came up with this case, I had to have me a side of Meatloaf. Just want to tidy that up right away before it gets out of hand. The year is 1973, a year that comes up so often in serial murder, it's uncanny. I, like many parents of the time, blame the music. I would do anything for love, but I won't do that. Do what, Meatloaf? Of course, that song wouldn't exist for another 20 years, but still, it haunts me. Russell Maurice Johnson exploded from the womb like a bat out of hell in 1947. Same year Meatloaf was born, actually, and that's weird. To be clear, Meatloaf has nothing to do with this case, which is extremely weird that I'm still fucking talking about him. It's just that, like I tried to establish in the beginning, I'm a little neurotic. I like to clean as I go, make messes, too. It's hard to be human. We get in our own way more than any other creature. You ever wish you were born a bug and someone would just come along and squish you? What am I doing here with this episode? I was supposed to be in 1973. Then there I went again, cramming in completely unnecessary quips. I love Meatloaf. I became obsessed after he keeled over on stage that one time and kept trying to get the words out. And I would do any... Hey, he starts to fall over. Oh, and I'll never forget the way I'm feeling right now. His fucking microphone hits the stage. He hits the stage. The guitarist comes walking up like, oh, Meatloaf fell over again. I'll link it in the show notes. It's the funniest thing I ever saw in my life. It still is, even after he died. Something about Meatloaf. The man I've grown to adore. Something so unnecessary that became completely necessary in Meatloaf. I can't pinpoint it. Something spooky but beautiful, the way he belted out ballads, like he loved to hate on love. Let me sleep on it. My reasons for loving Meatloaf. This is my neurotic nature, glowing like the metal on the edge of a knife. It's autumn of 1973. The place is London, Ontario, Canada. London, like many Canadian cities and towns, was named after its English counterpart. The legacy of Jack the Ripper shouldn't have come as part of the package, but incredibly it had, as London, Ontario was known for its serial killers. Though I doubt many of the perpetrators, especially this one, would ring a bell for you. He'd be more likely to climb through your window. The clean freak had been spotless in the beginning. Careful, meticulous, not even killing until he got tired of just breaking in and staring at women sleeping. He was building up to it. Speaking of, Russell Maurice Johnson was built like a building, a brick shithouse. He worked at the Ford Motor Plant and was, from outside appearance, just another sexy uncle clocking out to chase tail after every shift. Tall, dark, and handsome, well-spoken, stylish in his dress and choice of vehicles, by no means a raving lunatic. Far from the type of guy people would have suspected capable of killing an eventual seven women, not to mention the assaults and terrorizing in the build-up. Speaking of again, I missed a shift there in my own build-up in this story, chasing Meatloaf around with a fork until I was done. Let's take it from the top. I got a 3 a.m. start today, so forgive me, I was a little all over the road there. I now have both hands on the wheel, and though out here it's cold and lonely in the deep, dark night, I can see paradise by the dashboard light. Let's get this right. Ain't no doubt about it. We gotta get this fucking right. Russell Maurice Johnson was born in 1947, St. Thomas, Ontario. He grew up in conditions of extreme poverty alongside two brothers. His parents suffered from mental illness. His father enforced strict religious practices, requiring daily church attendance and weekly confessions from his kids. He also prohibited Christmas celebrations, citing anti-Semitic beliefs that commercial participation benefited Jewish-owned stores at the expense of Christians. The household environment was rigid and dysfunctional. At approximately age 13, Russell Johnson came to police attention for voyeuristic behavior and theft of women's underwear from clotheslines. His juvenile record included several sexual offenses. He experienced trauma in childhood, including sexual abuse around age 14. He quit school early. Russell Johnson was described as obsessed with cleanliness, a compulsive hand washer who wore gloves and used petroleum jelly at work and at the gym to protect himself from germs. He had previously worked as a bouncer. In 1969, he voluntarily admitted himself to the London Psychiatric Hospital, where he was diagnosed as a sexual deviant. Unbeknownst to anyone, he had begun committing sexual attacks and rapes as early as the same year of 69. Police Inspector Robert Young later reported that Johnson stated he would not have killed if he had received proper medical treatment at that time. Psychiatric diagnoses associated with Johnson include sexual sadism, necrophilia, transvestic fetishism, and voyeurism. Transvestic fetishism is dressing like a woman. This is all fancy ways of saying that he was into the idea of spying on women before breaking into their homes, tying them up, strangling them, then raping the body. Afterwards, he'd maybe dress up in their clothes and do the dishes, make a sandwich, then make the bed over the dead. And I'm not exaggerating. Lucky for the eventual bedroom strangler, his dark fantasies didn't count. Even when he began scaling apartments as high up as 15 floors, accessing balconies to get through open doors, and to the women that he'd killed and escaped from without signs of forced entry to their apartment, without, in some cases, signs that the death had been caused by murder. Even when Johnson would impersonate a cop or interact with cops outside his crime scenes, looking up disbelievingly at the height he'd climbed the night before to dispatch of the poor soul being removed on a stretcher under a sheet like a dead ghost, even then, it didn't count. Because nobody was counting. If a tree falls in the forest, and all that. Russell Maurice Johnson's number was eventually up, but not in the traditional sense. His kill count was already in serial killer territory. Fuck! His kill count was already well into serial killer territory before investigators even realized they had a serial killer in their territory. Though they'd responded to many of these murders, they didn't realize what they had on their hands until the blood began to show up on them. Good God! How many had they missed? Well, he'd tell you. You just had to catch him first. And when they finally did, Russell Johnson seemed relieved that he could finally tidy this up as much as possible, as I will do myself now. Dinner is done. Meatloaf is off the table and back in my headphones as I clean this up. On October 19th, 1973, Mary Catherine Hicks, age 20, a university student in London, Ontario, was found by her roommates in bed in a natural sleeping position with a pillow partially covering her face. She was neatly tucked in. Too neatly, some said. Too tightly. How did she do it? There were no visible signs of struggle, forced entry, or violence. Her death was initially attributed to a reaction to prescription medication. Johnson later confessed to entering the premises, watching her sleep, and then jumping her, strangling her, suffocating her, before leaving the scene as tidy as possible. And like I said, too tidy. Many of these cases, people would come in and say, how did they get the bed sheets so tight over them? Did they suffocate themselves by how tight that they pulled these bed sheets? Alice Jane Ralston, age 42, in Guelph, Ontario, November 30th, 1973, was found dead in bed with no obvious signs of trauma. Her death was initially attributed to hardening of the arteries.
Hardening of the arteries. Natural causes.
Johnson confessed later to strangling her. The scene initially appeared undisturbed and that nobody had come in there and done this, that she had tucked herself into bed and died. Maybe she did the dishes too. He would go and do the dishes. He would make himself a sandwich. It was fucking crazy. And then he'd climb back down the balcony. Eleanor Diane Hartwick, age 27, in London, Ontario, on March 4th, 1974, her body was found at home, appearing to have died peacefully in her sleep. Her death was initially attributed to a reaction to prescription drugs. Johnson later confessed to strangling her as well. The body was positioned to suggest a natural death, with one account noting a book had been placed in her hand that she had been reading, left by her bedside table. The scene was left tidy with no evident signs of struggle or forced entry. Doris Brown, 49, Guelph, Ontario. Her body was discovered on the morning of August 9th, 1974 by one of her kids. And I think it was an older kid of hers that was actually staying with her. She was very lucky not to have been killed herself. Doris was neatly tucked into bed with blankets pulled up under her chin. The pathologist noted minor abrasions in blood in the throat and rectum, but death was certified as pulmonary edema. Johnson later confessed to strangling her and sexually assaulting the body post-mortem. The scene was very orderly and wasn't initially thought to be a homicide. Diane Beats, age 23, Guelph, Ontario, December 31st, 1974, New Year's Eve. Her body was found in her apartment New Year's Day. Clear signs of homicide were present in this case. She had gotten engaged on New Year's Eve and was found by her fiancé the next morning. When he found her, he freaked out, left, but as he was leaving, he noticed that there were clothes of hers soaking in the sink. Johnson later confessed to strangling Diane with her own brassiere, binding her hands behind her back with a nylon stocking, and sexually assaulting the body post-mortem. He then tidied up. Was he washing away evidence? Or just being a clean freak and putting her clothes in the sink to soak? Johnson had prior knowledge of the building because his ex-wife had lived there. A homicide investigation from this case was launched immediately as it was obvious this was murder. Luella George, age 23, a hospital employee in London, Ontario. On the evening of April 15th, 1977, her body was found by a co-worker after she failed to report for her shift at the hospital that was nearby. Luella lived in an apartment occupied almost entirely by nurses and hospital staff. Her jewelry and undergarments were later recovered from a trash can nearby. Johnson confessed to scaling the exterior of the building to her fourth floor balcony, entering, strangling her, sexually assaulting the body post-mortem. He rearranged the bed to obscure the crime, but now the investigation was on to him. Donna Veldboom, Age 22, London, Ontario. July 16, 1977, her body was found in her apartment, which was located directly above the building where Johnson resided at the time. Johnson confessed to scaling the building exterior to gain entry, strangling her, then stabbing her in the chest with a knife, the first use of a blade in the series. He sexually assaulted the body post-mortem.
The reason, he said later, that he cut her was because he wanted to crawl into her body through the wound. Mentally ill, he certainly was.
Due to his obsessive-compulsive tendencies, he cleaned the body, washed the bloody linens, and tucked her neatly into bed. The homicide team was all over this. They're trailing him now. And when we're talking about scaling a building, if it's not obvious to you, he's climbing from balcony to balcony. Very dangerous. All of the cops later, investigators, people involved can't believe that he did this. I can. I mean, my dad used to climb the side of the building beside our house. I remember to go visit his friend, drunk, just go and say, oh, I'm going to go check on him, and climb up the side of the building. So guys did that back in the 70s and 80s. They were a little bit, fucked up. Speaking of fucked up, the clean freak, Russell Maurice Johnson, also known as the Bedroom Strangler or the Balcony Killer, was arrested in late July 1977 after tenants in Donna Veldboom's London apartment building identified him as a suspicious person, a possible suspect. He resided in the same building as Veldboom, as I mentioned, and had been observed behaving oddly in the vicinity of the crime scene. Undercover officers began tailing Russell Johnson. They were unnerved when the suspect began stopping his car in random neighborhoods and walking around. They were sure that he was going to a home or to an apartment to commit another act, another crime, but he would just go to the front of the apartment or a home and stare off into it, at it, you know, stare off into space around it, planning, I guess. And then he'd get back in his car and drive away again. Russell Johnson would later share with investigators that they'd been observing him wrestling with his demons, trying not to do it, but being helpless to them. He'd just be driving around when suddenly the urge would strike, and the next thing he'd know, he was tucking a dead body into bed. The killer shared that he'd be in disbelief after murdering a woman. The next day, it would all feel like a dream, a nightmare. He couldn't believe he'd scaled the side of some of the buildings. He was afraid of heights. Russell Johnson, whom there's not a lot of information on, if you can't tell, and not a lot of information on the crimes, but I'm doing my best. He was charged with first-degree murder of Diane Beetz, Luella George, and Donna Veldboom. These three cases formed the basis of the prosecution because physical evidence and witness identifications directly linked him to the scenes. At his trial in the Ontario Supreme Court in January of 1978, Johnson pleaded not guilty to the three charged murders. However, he had already provided police with an unsigned statement in which he admitted involvement, and during the proceedings he further acknowledged an uncontrollable urge to commit the crimes. He was found not guilty by reason of insanity, and the court determined that Johnson suffered from a mental disorder specifically diagnosed as sexual sadism, necrophilia, fetishism, voyeurism, transvestic fetishism, and a personality disorder not otherwise specified that rendered him incapable of appreciating the nature and quality of his acts or knowing that they were wrong. Pursuant to the verdict, Johnson was committed indefinitely to psychiatric care under the jurisdiction of the Ontario Review Board. He was initially placed in a maximum security forensic unit at what was then known as the Ontario Mental Health Center, Oak Ridge Division, in Penetanguishene, Ontario. The facility now operating as the Waypoint Center for Mental Health Care, he has remained institutionalized there since 1978. He's been there continuously. Following his commitment, Russell Johnson confessed in detail to four additional murders that had previously been classified as natural or unexplained deaths, those of Mary Catherine Hicks, Alice Ralston, Eleanor Hartwick, and Doris Brown.
And here I am cleaning as I go in the edit once again. He made a deal where he wouldn't be tried for any of the crimes that he admits to while in the mental institution. He comes to the investigators and says, I need to get this off my chest. I got to clean this up. He's neurotic. He can't leave things undone. He's got to tie up these loose ends. It's not so much about guilt. It's about
his OCD fucking with him. He's got to get it all out there. We got to clean this up. The clean freak. These earlier victims have been found neatly tucked into their beds with no obvious signs of violence, consistent with Russell Johnson's methodical modus operandi, consistent with Russell Johnson's methodical MO of stalking women living alone, scaling exterior walls or balconies to gain entry while they slept, and then observing them for extended periods before jumping them, sexually assaulting them, and then staging the scenes to appear non-suspicious. His confessions also encompassed approximately 10 to 17 non-fatal sexual assaults committed against other women in the London and Guelph areas between 69 and 77. In total, Russell Johnson admitted to 7 murders and a series of sexual offenses spanning nearly a decade. Russell Johnson has remained under indefinite detention at the Waypoint Center for Mental Health Care for more than 47 years. He has applied for almost 50 years. He has applied annually to the Ontario Review Board for more lenient conditions, including transfers to medium security facilities or escorted community privileges. These applications have been consistently opposed by the families of his victims. Review boards and courts have repeatedly denied his requests, citing his enduring danger to the public. A notable example occurred in 2012 when the Ontario Court of Appeal rejected his bid to transfer to the Brockville Mental Health Center. Subsequent decisions have upheld maximum security detention. As of the most recent available records, Russell Maurice Johnson continues to be held at the Waypoint Center for Mental Health Care in Penetanguishene, Ontario, under the strict oversight of the Ontario Review Board. Where the fuck? Oh, never mind. Fuck, it's at the end. And there you go. Started off a little messy, but I think I tidied this one up nicely. Maybe a little too tidy. Ah, you can't blame me. But you can blame the clean freak. And that will do it. I know I promised Thursday drops. I'm a little late or early. I'm not sure. I'm not really good at coming through on promises. But I promise to keep that up. Anyways, the Bedroom Strangler case is supposedly an infamous one here in Canada. And that will do it. I know I promised Thursday drops. I'm either late or early on this one. There's just a lot going on all the time. When I get the time to do these, and I have a lot of time, but like this one, I'm doing at 3 in the morning on a Sunday. I'll probably put it out right away. Really what I'm trying to promise is more frequent episodes. How about that? So, try for fucking Thursday, but whatever. Who gives a fuck? It's self-imposed, right? So, I just want to put up more episodes for you. And that's what I'm promising. Anyways, the Bedroom Strangler case is supposedly an infamous one here in Canada, though I'd never heard of it until I came across an article talking about Russell Johnson, now in his late 70s, having over the years made multiple requests to be allowed out in the community to go to Walmart and run other errands. So far, the answer has been no. Sorry, Russell, but we just don't think that would be appropriate, considering how you're like the most prolific serial killer from a time and place where that was a bit of a problem out there. You understand, don't you, Mr. Johnson? Then he starts singing a Meatloaf ballad. The windows fly open and he climbs down 7 stories to freedom. Goes to Walmart. Anyways, for more of this shit, sign up to Dark Topic Plus and unlock an archive of exclusive offerings. And unlock an archive, a growing archive, of exclusive offerings, including Dark Topic Plus, More Dark Topic, Brutal, The Luna Bin, Jack Luna's Dark Fiction, and more. Every month that archive grows, gain access to it via links in the show notes. I hope you're all well. I got a couple of quick shout-outs here I need to do. Tanya Bjork. Sorry, Tanya, I can't pronounce it better than that. Bjork, I think. Jordan Oki Wilson. Oki, Jordan, thank you so much for the high-level support. You and Tanya, thank you, Tanya. Thank you, Jordan. And thank you, Trent Grooms. Trent, I called you a retard on Facebook, and you came and signed up at the $25 tier, which shocked me. So thank you for turning our relationship around. I love this audience. I love the behavior of everybody coming back at me. I know I'm not the only one. Until next time, keep those eyes cocked, those doors locked, and stay paranoid. Big love, everybody. Talking to you real soon. And maybe since this one ran a little short, I busted through it. Again, there wasn't as much information as I hoped that there would be. I'll play you one of my dark fiction episodes, if you like. Would you like to hear a story? Here. Let's have a little story.
And I'm sorry for the neurotic nature of the episode. It wasn't intentional, but as I was editing it, I made sure it was intentional. I just left in some of the neurotic shit I do during episodes, the cleanup I do. So with this story I'm going to play, it's about the neurotic nature of Joseph James D'Angelo. Joseph James. You know, the Golden State Killer. The original Night Stalker. I wrote it, and it's one of my most neurotic stories. It didn't make the cut for 13 stories. It's somewhere in the back catalog of Patreon, but it's never been released on Apple Plus or anywhere else. So I hope you enjoy. All right, mood, everybody. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges. From sleepless nights to stress-filled days, Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies and functional flower crafted for your ideal mood, made with 100% federally legal THC. Not only that, but they'll deliver them discreetly right to your doorstep, and you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code DARKTOPIC. I've tried a bunch of their stuff myself, and it's wild how different each one feels. Their Sleepy Time gummies knock me out in about 15 minutes flat. No hangovers, no grogginess. I wake up feeling amazing. And their Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right, and you just need to hit the reset button on your crappy mood. What makes these different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're just not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. But their flower is what really blows me away. I'm like a flower in the wind. They partner with small family-owned U.S. farms who are custom cultivating their bud with unique terpene profiles. So you can choose a strain to help you feel more social, aroused, chilled out, even focused and productive. I'm into all that, and not necessarily in that order. I mean, they have cannabis products for literally everything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, sexual arousal, and each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on these small family-owned farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship directly to your door. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you listening can get 20% off your first order with code DARKTOPIC. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code DARKTOPIC at checkout to save 20% on your first order. Mood, everybody. One thing that might explain my neurotic nature is I recently did 23andMe, not sponsored, maybe in the future, along with hopefully something to replace all those fucking, language ads I've been having to do. I turned down a BetterHelp ad actually recently. Maybe I should have accepted it. I just don't think it works. I tried it. Clearly it doesn't work. Where the fuck am I? It's 23andMe. That's how they caught the original Night Stalker, actually one of those services. So I'm sorry to any of my future fucking, lineage who wants to be serial killers. I signed up for this fucking shit, so you're fucked. Sorry. And it came back that I have Neanderthal genes. I have more Neanderthal genealogy in me than 86% of people who have signed up for that. more than 2% of my DNA has Neanderthal in it. Which means you could be neurotic, or you're not afraid of heights, and you're not... can't sneeze if you got a fart and shit. I don't know what it was. Anyways, I also found out I'm 0.5% Iranian, so I got to go soon to fight for my brothers over there, which is probably going to be tough. 99.7% European. What else you want to know? Mostly Irish. A decent chunk of Italian, actually, too. Which is crazy because I named myself Jack Luna, and Luna's an Italian name, I think. And I always
wondered why the fuck I did that, and maybe it's just, fucking forget about it. I forgot about it, because I wasn't in touch with that side of my family on my mom's side, and just didn't know about it over here. So, I'm truly a Jack Luna type now, as my son said when he found out. I was like, you know, that means you're a little Italian too. Me, your grandma, you, Jack. And he said, Mamma mia. Let's play the story. Oh, and if I didn't mention Joseph James DeAngelo, he left a roast in his oven. And when he was arrested as the Golden State Killer, and he was worried about that roast in his oven. Hey, I left a roast in the oven when you guys arrested me. Can you go turn the stove off? So I wrote this story about that in a way. Well, I have everything set up to record with Deadbug and with Kent Chungus, and nothing's happening. And I think it's because there's a big storm rolling into where I'm at, and I don't have connection. I seem to be able to record, but maybe I can't connect with Deadbug out there in England. It's a really, really willy. It's a willy wild situation. I got up last night at midnight to my son standing above me saying, hey, I had a nightmare, can I come in? And I've always told him, hey, if things get fucking weird for you in that room that I know is haunted, I'll switch with you and I'll go battle those demons for you. You come take my spot, my sweaty pillow, my sweaty sheets, because I'm having a nightmare when you wake me up. So I get up, I go onto the couch. I don't actually go into his room because I think that that's weird to sleep in my son's bed. And I'm on the couch and I can't go to sleep, so I just further prepare. And it gets to around 3:30. I say, okay, probably time to crack a beer. Because I set aside these times to record. I try to record with Deadbug at 5 a.m., my brother at 7:30 a.m., and then Kent around noon. All in one day, so I could just have a blowout of just drinking a 2-4 and smoking 3 packs of cigarettes, because I'm trying to lay off of all that. And I get out here and the snow is blowing and the wind. Deadbug is the one who shows up promptly, punctual. You know, I respect him, respects me, like he always shows up and he's just not calling. So I message him, there's no answer. I call him, there's no answer. It's going to 5:30 now. It turns out the snowstorm knocked out my ability to connect with Deadbug, so this is all on me, just to be very clear. I'm not dead. He's not dead. Nobody's dead. I'm just dealing with dead air in a snowstorm. So I've been up, you know, a lot. And plus, the Toronto Maple Leafs are my favorite hockey team. My buddy, one of my best friend probably, Shaz, he's at the game last night against Tampa Bay. My father-in-law is watching it. We're going back and forth. I put the rest of my gambling winnings, which is $2,000, on the Leafs just to, you know, put the karma in the right situation. They lose 7-3 last night. And I'm just kind of in a state, sitting here going, where's Deadbug? You know, oh, listen, crows are fucking coming out. What time is it now? 6:48. Okay, that makes sense. They've ruined this neighborhood, these crows, since George died. My buddy George, old guy, used to shoot them. But now the crows are coming back in, so I'm going to have to start shooting them, I guess, with pellet guns. I'm not going to kill them like he did. I'm just sitting here smoking cigarettes, drinking beers, wondering what's going on. And I have this moment where I'm like, am I dead? Did I have this routine set up today? And did I die in the middle of the night? Because I remember before Jack came in to wake me up saying he had a nightmare, glimpsing a shadow figure standing beside my bed, thinking it was a nightmare. And I was just so tired, I didn't even care that there was a shadow figure standing in the room. That was my nightmare. He comes in with a nightmare. I'm like, did I die? And am I just going through the routine of my day right now? Supposed to meet up with Deadbug at 5 a.m. here, and I'm just sitting here like, am I dead? Am I rolling through? I'm being serious here. I have a real fear moment for the past hour and a half at this point. I'm like, did I die? I go out and I piss. I'm like, I still piss. I'm watching Kill Tony, you know, Tony Hinchcliffe, the best comedy, live comedy show in the world. And then I'm like, well, I guess I have time. I might as well record a Waking Up with Jack Luna. And this is what I'm waking up to. I haven't really slept. I know that you think I'm being silly right now, but I'm... Because what happened was I went back in and I walked to go get my boots because I put on shoes and it's cold out here. So I go to put my boots on, which are at the back door of the big bedroom that we have where my son and my girl and Charlie, our youngest, is sleeping. And I trip over a fucking controller for the PS4 and PS5. Who am I fooling, right? And none of them stirred. Anyways, if I'm dead, I think I should put out my lost Dark Fiction episode. I at least get this off my chest. This is something that I put away and thought that I would never put out there. I call it A Roast in the Oven. And it's about Joseph DeAngelo, the Golden State Killer. And it doesn't make any sense. But the writing, I think, is fairly good, and it's just kind of a work in progress. So I'm going to use this time to do something. And it's for Waking Up with Jack Luna. Anyways, this is called A Roast in the Oven. Lost Dark Fiction. Home stops being home when the head of it decides you're unwelcome. In this case, the mother had lost her head for a man, and the man had wanted everyone but her out. She was his now, and there was no room for her attention outside of his needs. He didn't announce this, of course, but it was obvious by the way he opened his paper, the way he cleared his throat, clanged his spoon into each morning's bowl of yogurt and granola, topped with fresh fruit, clanging the spoon continuously like a death knell on this family. Dogs can sense when they're not wanted. They'll choose the street over a cold home. But it takes time to be sure. And it's difficult if he never raises a hand and she never stops feeding you. Though you can tell by the way she lays your bowl down, by the reduced dose of love at each meal. When the man eats like a king and you get a dog's dinner. When she stops saying goodnight or good morning. When you go outside and begin to worry that the man will lock the door. It's time to move on. There's no plan. He's moving where the energy of the home has pushed him. Away. He's a runaway. Though one can't technically run away without somebody chasing them. Living without a home is exciting before it becomes scary. The sights and sounds of the city on a brisk fall day make anything seem possible. But when the sun sets and you become a shadow scattering for cover, the freedom reveals itself to be destitution. And the fear comes to ask, what will you do? And when he has no answer, when he tires of searching for one and simply curls up in an alleyway beside a dumpster, he accidentally conquers his fear. What's there to fear when what you're already afraid of is already here, happening? And besides, there's much to worry about. Warmth, food, water. Those three show up quick to take the mind off of self-pity. Fear becomes anger, and if it doesn't, you die. That's all. He fights for scraps, until one day a man takes him in. A thing that happens on the streets. Men will take you in. When you're just a pup, it's always women. But if you're grown, it'll be a man, and he won't be tender or sweet. He'll have the eyes of a snake, wet pebbles, impossibly black when filled with anger. And anger is a poor replacement for love, but at least there's attention in it. At least once the beatings are done, there's an apology, maybe even a treat. A warm place to sleep beside the man as he rubs your back and thanks you for not leaving him. Like all the rest, street men are like trash. If you root around in them, you might find something good. But there's a lot of worthless shit in there still. Reasons they've been discarded. Toxicity that manifests through abuse. They're always in a bad mood, talking down to you, beating you, even molesting when they get drunk and mean enough. But you know what? They'll never turn you away, and they'll never fail to share what little that they have. Because they know what it's like, these street men. Deserve it or not, they know how cold the world becomes without four walls, a fridge of food, and a TV. The television is the modern-day campfire. Gather around to keep warm and take comfort in all its distraction. But that's not here either. The dog doesn't understand what the man says, but it comprehends what it do. What it do, puppy dog, what it do? The old man gives the old boy a scratch and lets him in the tent. It's raining. And what it do? Well, it do good enough. And that's all a fever dream. Laying here, at dusk in a lumpy, oversexed motel bed about to kill himself. A lawnmower's engine bringing him back. It's funny how a sound, timed just right, in this case a lawnmower chugging to life at dusk, or a smell like a roast in the oven, can thaw a frozen moment, cleave a memory from the glacial past, send it splashing warm nostalgia over even the coldest heart. He hadn't wanted her to want it, this sleeping man, awake from his fever dream. So when the girl began to go along, he'd started strangling. And that did the trick. Nobody, after all, could feign enjoyment while having the life choked out of them. It had been late 78, and he spotted her sashaying down the street like a going-out-of-business sale on ass. Those hips swinging, that honey ham had called him over. The darkness inside seeming to meld with the darkness outside. He couldn't help it, like a dog to a bone. In this neighborhood, there's no doubt, she'd been looking to turn the first trick of the evening, fired up on crack smoke from her pimp's pipe. It was all too clear. And he'd been up to no good, taking a walk through this seedy, low-end Cali college dorm, Whoville. A few nice homes, but the rooming houses were crowding in. Young men and women far from home, eating noodles under a single bulb while cramming for a ticket to a future far from here. And some who drop out drop right into a drug den. They stay. The weather's nice. If things get bad in California, one can always just sleep outside. And maybe once this girl had had a dream that led her into this nightmare. She was so caught up in herself that she mistook the shadow for her own. Before he reclaimed it on the other side of the street, swiftly gaining ground before whipping an arm around the throat while stuffing her through a high, well-manicured hedge that seemed to absorb them from the street onto a wonderful yard. A paradise, really. On the slightly damp grass laid out like a carpet before a proud little bungalow, tucked back behind fruit trees. She'd fought it first. And for a moment he thought he would lose the battle here at 5 a.m. when a lawnmower started up behind them. An insane sound at dawn. The stout gorilla of a man is in his underwear, and if it weren't for the bright white of them, one would think him wearing black pajama bottoms. His legs are covered in thick hair. A witness to the rape this man is, and the rapist is about to bolt when lawnmower guy raises a thumb, then calmly begins cutting the grass. Smells of rain and garlic and meat. There's a roast in the oven. She tried screaming, but he jammed three fingers in her mouth and her eyes lit up with fear. Then they seemed to dim, and that's when she'd started to play along, grabbing his wrist and sucking his fingers, and something about that had set him off. And that's how the girl died, pretending she'd wanted it. Seems harsh to murder a girl because she'd attempted to make a rape easier on herself. An intelligent move, really, but boy, had it backfired. What had it been about that? What about her contrived willingness had set him off so monstrously? Certainly, she'd insulted his intelligence, but to be murdered for that alone seemed harsh. No, it had been that she'd ruined it. She'd ruined the best part. And in his fury, he'd left DNA everywhere. And it's the late 70s, and he doesn't even know what DNA is, but subconsciously, he'd known it a bad idea to take the condom off. And maybe, just maybe, he'd done it as a means to force an end to the attacks, as a way to gorge the greedy beast inside, satiate it once and for all, make it disappear, and leave him be. The rapist vows to call it a night, a career, the end of a thrilling nightmare, a phase. That one was one too many. That one, that first, was too far. He's over it. The cool down lasts little more than 5 months, and it wasn't planned to end. He just suddenly couldn't help himself. And even though the next girl struggled like she should have, he killed her anyways. strangulation again. And what the fuck was all that about? He's a serial killer now or something? Well, not quite yet. He'll need one more, from what he's read. But that is not going to happen. He won't do it. And he doesn't, for 10 years, he doesn't grab another girl, another than his wife, whom he marries soon after number 2. Number 15, if you want to include all the rapes leading up to number 1, but he doesn't count those. Doesn't even think about those. Ask any huntsman for a story and he'll recall what's on his wall. The rest are just idle amusement, practice, catch and release. Forgot. There's another rapist in the East area. He's piling plates on the husband's backs, claiming he'll kill them both if one breaks. And that's a relief, someone to share the heat with. But then in the summer of 91, at the age of 53, he comes home from work to find his wife hog-tied on the floor of their bedroom, clearly raped, clearly murdered. And to himself, he chuckles a little and thinks, well, what goes around comes around. Ain't that a bitch? You reap what you sow, and so on. The man even feels a sense of relief, for if there is a God, perhaps this serves as a form of punishment, and he'd take it easy on him for those girls he raped and murdered back in the day. But karma's not done yet. An investigator stops by to request a DNA sample from the man, to rule him out. And it's then that he realizes it's time to go. Killing himself seems like the right thing to do, but he's not convinced of other worlds than this. And there's always been a part of him that believed the dark to be just as, if not more, powerful than the light. So he takes a gamble and kills the cop, who stopped by to request the swab. He'd shot the poor guy, in the face to be sure. And the third murder of the man's life brought him no ecstasy. He wasn't into men. But what did give him a little thrill was the fact he'd now become a serial killer. And as he leaves his home, choosing the cop car rather than his own so as to get away quick, speeding to the highway while keeping a close ear on the radio, he realizes they'll pin his wife's murder on him now, which bothers the man a little. Not for any reason other than that whoever did it should get the credit. And that's a sick thought, but it's his only thought on the matter. And even though he loved his wife, he never really cared about her, or their kids for that matter. 2 boys, both grown and living their own lives, whatever. It just wasn't there. Again, he loved them, but the man loved human beings the way a man loves a dog. Sure, you're sad when they go, but that's life and you get over it. Get a new one even. He's too old for all that, though. A new wife? The man now only wants to kill women. It's the only thing he's ever truly enjoyed. So he stashes the cop car in the depths of Sacramento and gets on a bus to nowhere. When he sees the right stop, he gets out, grabs a room, gets some food, gets some sleep, and then sees how many girls he can kill in one day. Even though the grass is ready for its sheet of leaves, then blankets of snow, and is laid low to the ground in acceptance of summer's end, there's a fucking knucklehead somewhere across the street from the motel, using a lawnmower. What time is it? Also, where am I? Oh yeah, right, he was in some shit little wannabe city. Visalia, is it? On the run for killing a cop and suspicion for killing his wife. Good God, what a strange turn of events. Whoever said life was short sure hadn't lived much. Repetition of routine can trick a mind into experiencing time funny. It slips away in sheets rather than chunks. And for the man, he knew he was entering his final chunk of time. In a very chunky life. Sheets of leaves, sheets of snow, sheets of grass, and on we go. Does it snow in California? And the year? What year is it? What month? What day even? The man has no idea. He compresses a sticky button on his Indiglo watch and sees it's 7:30 p.m. He also sees that there's gravy on his wrist and remembers the roast in the oven. He'd been cooking a roast when the man with the DNA coffee cup had come and arrested him. The man swings his hairy legs at a bed, realizing they're covered in some type of fabric. An orange jumpsuit. He managed to get it on before collapsing into the crib of this one-star motel room. He'd been in a hurry to recharge, knowing full well killing a cop and hoping to get away with it was like smacking a beehive than putting your dukes up. He'd been a cop himself once, and knew they'd be swarming him soon. Somebody on the bus or on the walk to the motel, or most likely of all the clerk he checked in with, would recognize him from the news. His face would be plastered on the stack of papers out in the lobby and in the box he could see on the street from his room window. That neurotic fool mowing the evening's dew beyond had probably read about it over his toast. It may even be the reason he's up cutting grass at 7:30 in the evening, on a Friday, the 13th it is. September of 1996, as told by his blood-spattered watch. How fitting. So what's the plan then? Yes, kill some girls. A pastime he thought lost to a chunk of time, but now that he was cornered, why not paint the last square on his board a deep red? Paint the town red, as they say. And what did that ever mean? Something told him it meant fireworks or old-time bonfires? Some odd conversation he once had in an Irish pub slowly swimming back from somewhere. You see, life is long. That fucking lawnmower, Christ. A knock on the door, oh good. Well, that's that then. Another thing about life, one's death is really remarkable. It just kind of happens, no matter how long you prepare for it. He grabs his gun and reminds himself to hold it firm against the roof of his mouth. Waking up handcuffed to a hospital bed with a bad case of mental retardation would be a most unpleasant chunk of life to coast out on. Another knock on the door, this time smaller. Then the door is opening. What the fuck? How had he locked the door? How sloppy can one guy be? The man brings the gun to his mouth, in a flash thinking, we're about to find out. And now he's grinning as the metal passes his lips, which is maybe a remarkable death. To suicide while smiling in a shitty motel room, while being serenaded by a lawnmower at 8:30 on a Friday evening, the 13th to boot, after you found your wife dead by the hand of a likely serial killer, which turned you into a serial killer after a couple decades of dormancy from a serial rapist career gone awry. Yes, his life is chunky. Now who is it? Let's make this ceiling chunky. Joseph? Are you alright in here? And in walks his wife, followed by the cop he killed. Huh. They close the door behind them and stand side by side in the near darkness of that end of the shitty little motel room. Again, this time she's scolding in her tone. Joseph, D'Angelo, are you alright in here? The lawnmower cuts out, finally, and the three stand in silence. Joseph doesn't dare speak. He knows they're dead. And when he hears a knock on the motel room window behind him, he doesn't turn around. It's the girls. He knows that too. And there aren't two, there are 13. Some of the men who have been in the way, like this dead cop that used to be him, standing in the shadows of the motel room. There's a roast in the oven. Mr. D'Angelo, we'd like to ask you some questions if you feel mentally fit enough to answer them. The gun in his mouth is a microphone. The motel at courthouse. Do you understand, sir? And the Golden State Killer looks up, bleary-eyed to the court, and understands. Yes. 13 times, and yes. And more. There's a roast in the oven. Does anybody get that yet? What is it going to take to get that roast out of the goddamn oven? And that is a fucking insane story that makes no sense. I hope you hung in there. I hope you didn't, actually. Dogs barking. Joseph D'Angelo always pissed about the dogs barking. You know the Golden State Killer, right? There was a roast in the oven when he got arrested. He was a cop. Killed a whole bunch of fucking women. Everything's fucking strange to him now that he's an old man. But who gives a fuck?